We have a fun podcast today. This is the last podcast before the Pesach break. Next week, because it's Pesach, there is no Parsha. So for the first time in a very long time, yours truly is not going to have to record a Parsha podcast. I'm not going to have to come to the Torch Center and to sit down in front of the microphone and to share with you an idea that you will find interesting and entertaining. I'm going to be off. I don't know what I'm going to do. Maybe I'll sleep in late. Maybe we'll go on a short vacation to the Caribbean. Maybe we'll just relax. What's that like? What should we do? Should we go boating? Should we go swimming? Should we just lounge around? Should we do a bicycle tour? Rollerblading on the bayou? I don't know what we're going to do. But next week, we are off. It's Pesach because it's Pesach. We don't have a parsha. And therefore, we're going to not have a podcast next week. The following week, we'll have the upcoming Parsha. But this week, it's the week before Pesach. A week from today, Pesach is already underway. And I'm sure all of y'all are busy in your frantic Pesach preparation, as am I will tell you. But I snuck here to the Torch Center to record something which I found to be very interesting. I think it's a powerful idea. It's something that I really, really enjoy. I think it's both topical to the festival upcoming and Parsha related. It's powerful. It's interesting. It's exciting. It's fun. And it's also maybe a bit distressing. And that to me is the perfect combo, the perfect concoction. It's interesting. It's stimulating. It's intriguing. And it's a little bit unsettling. That's the sweet spot here for the Parsha podcast. It's year 8 of the Parsha podcast. We go deep and deeper. Let us begin. This week, we only have one segment. Really, it's one and a half. We'll call it one and a half segments on this week's Parsha. It's Parsha's Metzora. Typically, Parsha's Tazria and Metzora are together because this year is a leap year. We have two Adars. We had two Adars. We're already in the month of Nisan. We had two Adars already. Therefore, we need more Parshios, and therefore, there are no double Parshios this year, with the exception of Matos Masei, which almost always is together even during leap years. And the subject matter of our Parsha, it's a continuation of last week's Parsha. It's the subject of Metzora, purity and impurity, and specifically the type of impurity that comes from Tzaras. There's a discoloration on your skin, on your garment, on your home, as we learned this week. And that's a sign that the Almighty is trying to send you a message. You need to improve. You need to repent. You are doing something wrong. The Talmud lists 7 different transgressions that may be the cause of Tzaras. Primary amongst them is Lashon Hara, speaking evil about someone else. When you speak evil about someone else, the Almighty will send you a message in the form of some sort of skin disease, skin disorder that could appear on your skin, but it could also be on your garment as a discoloration in your garment or on your home. And there are various different processes and protocols that you must follow in order to ameliorate, in order to atone and cleanse that particular sin, and thus to remove the blemish, the discoloration, the tzaras that the sin caused. And if we look at this subject more broadly, we can collect a very interesting list of people and things that were stricken with tzaras. So, of course, we know when Moshe was instructed by God, commissioned by God to go save the Jewish people, this is the beginning of the book of Exodus, he initially resisted. He demurred. He said, I'm not worthy. They're not worthy. They won't believe me. And so on. This is the whole burning bush episode in chapters 3 and 4 of the book of Exodus. Moshe, he witnesses something very unusual, the burning bush. He goes to investigate. The angel representing God starts to speak to him and says, I saw the suffering of the Jewish people. Go save them. And Moshe launches a series of objections, culminating, of course, with the objection that we like to revisit a lot here on the Parsha podcast. He says, go send Aaron instead. But along the way, Moshe accuses the Jewish people of not believing him, of not having faith. I'm going to go. I'm going to say I'm coming to save you, and they will not believe me. And God tells him, take your hand, stick it into your garment. He sticks it in. He pulls it out, and his hand is white. It's white like snow. And Rashi there tells us that Moshe spoke Lashon Hara. He spoke evil talk against the nation, and therefore he was immediately stricken with tsaras. He stuck his hand back in, and when it reemerged, it was once again restored to the color of his skin. So Moshe is the first person documented in the Torah that had tsaras. Now later on in the Torah, Moshe's older sister, Miriam, this is in the book of Numbers, she speaks Lashon Hara against her brother, against Moshe. She equates herself and other prophets, and prophetesses, that's a hard word to say, prophetesses with Moshe. And because that is a degradation of Moshe's greatness, so she spoke negatively about her brother, she was stricken with tsaras. This is the end of Parshas Bahaloscha. Now, in addition to these two, our sages tell us that the serpent in the Genesis story, he spoke evil when he conversed with Eve, and therefore he too was stricken with tsaras. And in fact, the scales on the skin of a snake, that symbolizes the, so to speak, discoloration, the disorder that the snake has in its skin. It has tsaras. Cain, we're told, Cain and Abel. This is not explicit in scripture, but it's featured in literature. Cain, he had tsaras. Pharaoh, in the beginning of the book of Exodus, the verse tells us that the Jewish people, they reached just this point where they were not able to bear it anymore, and they cried out to God, and God heard, and God understood, and God saw their suffering. This is, I believe, in the end of chapter 2 of the book of Exodus. And our sages tell us that Pharaoh, he had tsaras. He was stricken with this skin disorder. And his physicians told him that the only way to be healed from this is if you take a bath in blood. And our sages tell us that every morning he would slaughter 150 Jewish babies and bathe in their blood. And then at night he would do the same with another 150 Jewish babies. And that was too much. And that was the breaking point for the Jewish people. And they cried out to God. And that's kind of the beginning of the shift from servitude, from oppression to salvation. So we have a very interesting list here. We have the snake, we have Cain, we have Moshe, we have Miriam, we have Pharaoh. Of course, once you go to the rest of the prophets, we spoke about this last week, Naaman, the general, King Uzziah, Gehazi and his sons. We're told in the Talmud that David, after his sin with Bathsheba, he too was stricken with tsaras. It's a very interesting motley mix of people, some of the greatest giants we've ever had, and some of the worst villains. Now, what's really interesting is that there's another figure, a very important figure in our history and our philosophy. There's another figure that was stricken with tsaras, or that is stricken with tsaras, and that is Messiah. Messiah. What do we know about Messiah? So if you are listening to my other podcast channel, one of my other podcast channels called Torah 101, you know that we spent 16 episodes going through the subject of Messiah to its depth and its breadth. So you know a lot about Messiah, but most people, I'm assuming most people, even you, most likely you didn't listen to Torah 101. You're a Parsha podcast guy, but not the Torah 101. That sounds too rudimentary for me. I'm advanced. Maybe 201, maybe 301, not 101. Well, I would first of all encourage you to listen to the podcast channel, Torah 101, because it is wonderful. At least that's what I think. But of course, I'm biased. But most people don't know anything about Messiah. But the basic contours of the idea is that Messiah is the third of this triumvirate. Abraham, Moshe, Messiah. Abraham is the founder of the Jewish people. Moshe, he's the one who brought us Torah. He kind of formed us into a nation, not just a family, but into a nation. And the third of this troika, well, that's Messiah. And Messiah is the one who brings us to our perfection. And alongside that, brings the whole world to its perfection. And if, I mean, we've spoken about this in the past, when Abraham, He travels to the Binding of Isaac episode. He's traveling on a donkey. And then when Moshe travels to Egypt, he too is traveling on a donkey. And our sages tell us that there is a third person who's going to travel on this very same donkey, and that is Messiah. These three symbolize the three epochs of history. Abraham, he ends the era of chaos and darkness. He conceives of this idea of the Jewish people. He conceives of this world where God is known to all, where the knowledge of God is ubiquitous. Moshe is the one who coalesces the nation as a single entity and gives us our marching orders with the Torah. And the third and final element, the final leader that we're going to have, this transcendental leader that will lead us towards our perfection, well, that is Messiah. He's a king, and he's going to rule over our nation, but eventually the whole world, and he's going to rebuild the temple, and he's going to restore all the laws, and gather in the nation from the four corners of the earth, and so on. And we're told that Messiah is scheduled to come in the month of Nisan. So we had two Adars, now we're in the month of Nisan. And in the month of Nisan, that's going to be, we don't know when Messiah is going to come, but we do know that some significant event in the revelation of Messiah will happen in the month of Nisan, maybe still this month of Nisan. So it's topical, and it's also the parsha, because we find many sources that tell us that Messiah is associated with Tzaras. For example, the Talmud tells us, this is in the book of Sanhedrin, on page 97a, it tells us that in the times of Messiah, there's going to be a terrible devolution in the world. And there will be a lot of brazenness, and there will be a lot of inflation, and wine will be very expensive, and the whole kingdom will turn into heresy, and there will be no rebuke. So it's describing the features of the world of Messiah. And the Talmud tells us, Ein Bein David Ba, the son of David, the scion of David. Messiah will not come until the whole kingdom turns into heresy. So if you only have partial heresy, the kingdom is partial heresy, partial non-heresy, that's not the conditions for Messiah, the Talmud tells us. The entirety of the kingdom has to be transformed into heresy. And the Talmud says, well, what's the scriptural source for this idea? How do we see in the Torah this notion that in the times of Messiah, there will be rampant, ubiquitous heresy? You would think the times of Messiah, well, that's the time of positivity, where there's going to be faith in the world, not heresy. So the Talmud says, wait a minute, what's the citation that you could bring? What's the source to prove this idea that when there is totality of heresy, that's when Messiah will come? And the Talmud cites a verse from Tzaras, a verse in last week's parsha. It tells us that when a person is covered with a splotch of Tzaras, they are impure. If 98% of their body is covered in Tzaras, they are impure. If 99.9% of their body is covered in Tzaras, they are impure. But if 100% of their body is covered in Tzaras, then, quite counterintuitively, then they are pure. Similarly, the Talmud explains, when the world is partially covered in Tzaras, partially covered in heresy, well, there's no purity. There's impurity. But if there was a world where there is 100% impurity, 100% Tzaras, well then, Messiah will come. And this very much resembles a theme of Messiah in the literature, that there are actually two different scenarios in which Messiah can come. Either when everything is righteous, and therefore you would expect, well, this righteousness, the world is primed for this next stage of history, the next epoch of history for Messiah. But there's an alternative way that Messiah can come in a generation that's entirely wicked. Entirely wicked. Completely covered in Tzaras. There is no redeeming element of purity. It's 100% impurity. Counterintuitively, that That's the circumstances. That's the conditions in which Messiah can come. It's a very interesting concept, and you want to hear more about that idea. You have to listen to the Torah 101 podcast channel, where we discuss this at length. But anyhow, what we do see, what we do observe from this teaching in the Talmud, is that there is some sort of connection between Messiah and Tsaras. That's only one of the sources that I want to address, or at least one of the sources that prove this notion that Messiah is associated with Tsaras. The second source is much more direct. So if the previous source was in the Book of Sanhedrin, page 97a, this second source is also in the Book of Sanhedrin, not 97a, but 98a. And the reason why these are so close to each other is because those pages of Talmud, 97, 98, 99, and so on, in the Book of Sanhedrin, they are completely dedicated to the subject of Messiah. But it tells us like this. It tells us a story. One of the great sages of the Talmudic era, his name was Rabbi Yehoshua, Joshua, ben Levi, the son of Levi. He was conversing with Elijah the prophet. So there's a conversation here between a great sage and Elijah the prophet. We know Elijah the prophet, he was a prophet, but he transitioned into an angel, and thus he didn't die, and there are many, many sightings of Elijah throughout history. In fact, many of the sages of the Talmudic era, they would have frequent encounters with Elijah. So it tells us that Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, the sage, he is conversing with Elijah the prophet. And what do you ask Elijah if you meet him? You know, we would ask is, well, what are the winning lottery tickets for the Powerball drawing? Or what stock should I buy? Give me some stock tips. Who's going to win the election? There's lots of questions that we would ask. But what does the great sage ask Elijah? He asks him the most important question. Will I merit a portion in Olam Haba, in the world to come? Will I be fortunate and meritorious enough to be worthy of inclusion in the world to come? So first of all, we learn from this that one of the great sages was not sure. All of us are confident that we're pretty righteous. We're pretty good. Maybe not perfect, but we're pretty good. We're certainly worthy of a space, a slot in the afterlife. The great sage wasn't so convinced. So he asks Elijah, am I meritorious to earn a portion in the world to come? So Elijah responded, if the Almighty is thus desirous, then you will be worthy of the world to come. If Hashem wants for you to enter the world to come, then you will enter. So Rabbi Yehoshua responds, two I saw, and the voice of three I heard, meaning I see myself, I see you, and I hear the Almighty. So that is an indication that Elijah is kind of referencing God's presence, and Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi is acknowledging that as well. I hear God as well. Okay, so that question is not resolved. Elijah tells him, if God indeed deems you worthy, you'll be worthy, and we don't know exactly what the conclusion of that is quite yet. And then he has a follow-up question. What's his second question? The second question that Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi asks Elijah. Amos Asi Mashiach. When is Messiah coming? The question that throughout our history, it's been asked millions of times. Because we know Messiah is coming. It's foretold in the Torah. It's prophesied in the Torah. All the prophets talk about it. But there is no date that we know of. So Rabbi Shmuel Levi asks Elijah, well, you're a prophet after all. You could let me know. The Talmud does tell us that, in fact, the prophets, they were able to forecast the events surrounding Messiah. And they knew when it would come. So Rabbi Shmuel Levi says to Elijah, well, tell me, when's Messiah coming? I'm so curious. I want to know. So Elijah tells him, why are you asking me? Don't ask me. Go ask Messiah yourself. Now that's a strange response, because if we knew who Messiah was, maybe we can fulfill that. But Elijah tells the rabbi, go ask Messiah yourself. He says, well, I don't know who he is and where he is. How do I locate him? Where do I find him? Where is Messiah dwelling? Where is he sitting? Where can I find him? So Elijah tells him, where you find him? He is at the entrance of the city of Rome. Out of the city, by the entrance of the city, you'll see him. He's one of the people there. And how do I find him? Which one? Maybe what if there are 10 people there? What if there are 100 people there? So Elijah tells him, this is how you find Messiah. Out of the city, there are people who are in quarantine. There are people who have tsaras. There are people who are stricken with leprosy. And you'll see a lot of people, and they all have tsaras. They all have this illness. And they're all dealing with the discomfort of their conditions. And they're all wrapped up in bandages. They're all trying to get healed from their illnesses. And you'll notice one of them is behaving in a bit of an odd way. Whereas everyone else, when they want to change their bandages, so if they have, let's say, 5 or 6 different splotches where they have tsaras and they're trying to deal with the wounds, with the illnesses. So everyone else, they would undo all the bandages and then apply the lotion or whatever they're trying to do to alleviate their condition. So they remove all the bandages and then reapply new bandages all at once. So if you have 5 or 6 different bandages, you take them all off. And then you reapply the new bandages. But you'll see one of the people, one of the lepers, one of the people who have tsaras outside of Rome, he's behaving strangely. Instead of taking off all the bandages and then reapplying them all at once, he does it one at a time. He takes off one bandage and then he does whatever he needs to do, takes care of business, and he puts it back on and he moves on to the second bandage and so on. And the reason why he does that, Elijah reveals to Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, is because Messiah knows that he's on call. He's on call. What if it's time for Messiah to come? And if he's half bandaged up, it's a problem. He'll need to finish applying all his bandages. So he only takes one off at a time and reapplies that wound or reapplies the bandage to that wound. So that way there's a much shorter amount of time that he could be ready. He could be ready at a moment's notice. Instead of having to put on 6 bandages, the maximum bandages he'll have to put on, if he's called, if he's summoned, if he's paged to go act as Messiah, the maximum is 1. That's how you find Messiah. This is utterly fascinating. Elijah, the prophet, tells the great sage, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, how to find Messiah. He is a leper, a metzora, outside the gates of Rome. And he's on call. He's ready to go. And therefore, when he's tending to his wounds, he removes them one at a time. He unties, applies whatever ointment he has to put on, puts it back on, reapplies the bandage one at a time, as opposed to everyone else that's doing it all at once. Why? Because Messiah is always on call. Maybe, this moment, it's time for him to be summoned to go save the nation, save the world. Fascinating. Okay, so what happens? So Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi goes there. He goes to Rome, and he goes out to the city, and he spots all the people that are there, and he sees one of them, in fact, acting the way Elijah described. And he walks over to him and says, Messiah, nice to meet you. Shalom Alecha, Rabbi Amori, peace be upon you, my master, my teacher. I know your secret. You're Messiah. Nice to meet you. So he responded back. What did Messiah tell Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi? He responded in kind, Shalom Alecha Bar Levi. Peace be upon you, the son of Levi. So Messiah acknowledges him, not just him, but also his father. So Rabbi Shimon Levi tells Messiah, well, when are you coming? Le'em as asimar, when are you coming? And he responded with one word. Hayom, today. Rabbi Yoshua Levi packs his bags, heads back home, all ready. Today's the day, so exciting, amazing, Messiah, reveal to me when he's coming. And of course, Messiah did not come. It was a false alarm. And the next time he meets Elijah, he says, he debriefs him, well, what happened? So the first thing he tells him, well, I greeted him, he greeted me back. So Elijah says, wait a minute, Messiah greeted you? Shalom Alecha Bar Levi, peace be upon you, son of Levi. If Messiah acknowledged you and acknowledged your father, then I know for sure, your first question, do I have Olam Haba, am I meritorious enough to be included in those who have the afterlife? There's no way that Messiah would have acknowledged your existence or the existence of your father if you were not meritorious. So the fact that he acknowledged you and he greeted you, we know that both you and your father are guaranteed slots in heaven. Okay, so the first question is resolved. But then he tells Elijah, this Messiah is a bit fraudulent. He's a liar. He's dishonest. Because he told me that he's coming today. That was some time ago. He didn't come. He said, Hayom, today I'm coming. And today came and went, and Messiah did not come. So Elijah tells him, no, you only heard part of his answer. His answer wasn't, Hayom, today I'm coming. His answer was, Hayom, im bekol tishmahu. You missed a critical part of his answer. Today, I'm coming, provided, so long as, conditional upon, im bekolo tishmo. This is a verse in Psalms. Psalms 95, verse 7. Today, if you hearken to God's voice. Messiah is ready at a moment's notice, provided, even today, provided that we hearken to God's voice. If we listen to God, if we are worthy of, in fact, being a people, a nation that is completely adhering to the word of Hashem, then Messiah comes. So you heard the first word of his answer, Hayom. That's true, today, Hayom, but you missed the condition, im bekol tishmo, if in his voice you shall hearken. Thus concludes the Talmud. Very, very, very fascinating. Now, the first thing is, it's also interesting. There's a bit of a contradiction in the narrative, because Messiah is tying and untying his bandages. Why? Well, why is he not doing like everyone else? Untie them all and do all the ointment and then reapply them all at once? He's behaving like that because he has to be on call. He has to be ready at a moment's notice in case he is summoned. So evidently, Messiah does not know when he will be summoned. That's the implication. So this whole mission is to ask Messiah, when are you coming? And the description that we have of Messiah is someone who does not know when they're coming. So that's a contradiction that people ask on this Talmud. But that's only part of the fascinating, interesting insights that are being conveyed over here. And for our purposes, we see that Messiah is described as a Metzora, as someone who has Tzaras, and he's sitting outside of Rome. When we think of Messiah, we think of a king. In fact, the Rambam, when he talks about Messiah, he describes him as Melech HaMashiach, the king Messiah. A king. A king is not a leper. A king is not an outcast. A king is not someone who was kicked out of the city, who is suffering from this malady. Why is Messiah described as a Metzora? And this question is, of course, debated in the commentaries. the basic answer that the commentaries offer is that Messiah, because he is a king, he's representing the whole nation. And based upon the concept that we're all really one soul, and therefore our merits and our reward and our punishment really can be distributed across the nation. One person sins, the other person's really guilty for their sin because they're just two halves of one whole, two elements of one larger entity. Messiah is a person that suffers a lot, and his suffering cleanses the misdeeds and the sins of many of his compatriots. Just as if a single person, the Talmud tells us, if God forbid someone suffers, no one wants to suffer at all, but that cleanses a person's soul. A sin causes a blemish to the soul. The soul is corrupted. The soul is sullied. And there are various ways to ameliorate that. I just said the word ameliorate for the second time of the podcast. So let me undo that. There are various ways to remedy that. There are various ways to undo that. Of course, there's repentance. And then there's punishment. And what punishment does is it cleanses. It purges the sin from the soul. The Talmud tells us very clearly, Yisurim Mimarkim. Yisurim, suffering, that cleanses a person, that purges a person from the effects of sin. And it's possible, the Talmud tells us, for one person to suffer, and that, even though they're not really deserving of suffering, but that cleansing does not go for naught. It cleanses those around them, their family, their community, and their nation. Maybe even the whole world. So one of the themes here that the commentators suggest is that Messiah's a Metzora, this great leader, he's suffering, not for his own sins, but for ours. And when he receives the bountiful cleansing as a result of his suffering, that spills over to the rest of the nation, and our souls are cleansed. That is one idea. But there's a second question. Why is Messiah outside of Rome? Shouldn't he find a better place to hang out? Of all places. So Messiah's a Metzora, that's question number one. But he's outside of Rome? Rome is the empire, the people, the nation that destroyed the temple. These are mortal enemies of ours. The suffering that we endured at the hands of the Romans is almost unparalleled. Maybe it's the worst. Maybe the Egyptians, I don't know. But it's certainly one of the worst villains, one of the worst villainous nations. That's the Romans. What's Messiah doing there? Why is he stationed outside Rome? Now, this is a question I also researched and I found several answers. The easiest answer is, well, no, when it says Rome in the Talmud, it doesn't mean Rome in Italy. There's a city in Israel, in the Holy Land, called Rome. And just like there's a Cleveland, Texas. And there's a Paris, Texas. And they're not to be confused with Cleveland, Ohio, or Paris in France. And there is a East Palestine, Ohio, and that's not really like the other Palestine, but it's similar in one way that it's a total disaster zone. And of course, I know, it's not called Palestine, it's Palestine. But there's a Rome in Israel. And maybe that's where the Roman Caesars vacationed. We know that there was an underground tunnel connecting the home of Rabbi Judah the Prince and the Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius Antoninus. So obviously, the Talmud talks about that quite famously and memorably in the book of Avodah Zarah on page 10b. And they would study together. Then he would go through the tunnel to go visit the great rabbi, and they would study. So obviously, this is not in Rome. The tunnel does not connect Rabbi Judah the Prince's home on the coastal parts of Israel. It doesn't go under the Mediterranean, obviously. So they had some sort of, we know there's a city called Caesarea. Why is there a Caesarea in Israel? Because, well, the Caesars, they named a city that they ruled in Israel, named after the Caesar, Caesarea, and so on. We know Caesarea. So maybe there was a Rome in Israel, and maybe that's where he was hanging out, which is an interesting suggestion. Now, actually, Rashi in his commentary, he says something quite novel. He says that when Messiah is outside the city of Rome, he's not outside the physical city of Rome. He's in heaven. He is in paradise. But heaven corresponds to this world. And where in heaven, where in paradise, is Messiah stationed? He's in the part of paradise that corresponds to the city of Rome. That's the second answer, which again raises questions of its own and doesn't really fundamentally address our question. Our question is, why is he outside of Rome? And even if you tell me that he's outside of Rome in heaven, well, why is he outside of Rome in heaven? Why is he not in Jerusalem of heaven? If heaven, if paradise, if Gan Eden corresponds to the whole world, well, there's a Rome in heaven. There's also a Jerusalem in heaven. Shouldn't he be there? I want to suggest an idea. It's a bit of a frightening idea. I like this idea. This is the kind of idea that I like. It's a little frightening. It's a little distressing. But I think it's very interesting and thought-provoking. What is a Metzora? Again, we call it a leper. It's not really a leper because it's a spiritual disease. But the first thing we know about a Metzora is that they are unwelcome. They must go outside of the city. They have to be alone, away from the rest of the populace. And of course, no one wants to be around them. No one wants anything to do with them. Everyone is scared that they will be stricken with whatever the Metzora has. So they're ostracized. They're a pariah. They're persona non grata. They are viewed as trouble. They have a disease. They have an illness. They have something wrong with them that maybe is a bit contagious, and no one wants any part of it. So they have to get out of there. Get out of here. Go away. I don't want to be near you. That's a Metzora. A Metzora is someone who is expelled from the city. And society wants nothing to do with them. Society distances themselves from the Metzora, from the leper. Messiah, he is indeed a Metzora. He is unwanted. He is fundamentally incompatible with society, but not all societies. Specifically, he is unwanted, he is unwelcome in Rome. Messiah is a Metzora outside of Rome. He is anathema to Rome. Now we know this is a very well-established principle in our philosophy, that Rome is the embodiment of one of our relatives. That cousin, that uncle that we're not so proud of. Rome is the embodiment of Esav. In the end of Parshas Vayishlach, chapter 36 of Genesis, it lists the various families and tribes and conquests and chieftains, and leaders of Esav. And the last one it mentions is Aluf Magdiel, the chieftain Magdiel. And Rashi tells us, Ze Romi, this is Rome. Rome comes from Esav. Perhaps you recall when Jacob, Yaakov, and his twin brother Esav, when they were in utero, it was a dramatic gestation. They were fighting. They were struggling. They were at each other's neck in utero. And Rebecca, the mom, she didn't know what to do with herself, so she went to the prophet. And the prophet tells her, Shnei goyim bevitneich, there's two kingdoms, there's two nations within you. Ula'om el'om yematz, and they're going to fight with each other. V'rav ya'avot tzair. And the older one will ultimately be subject to the younger one. There's two nations within one person, Rebecca. One is Jacob and one is Esav. Rashi tells us that this is embodied by Rabbi Judah the Prince, who was the leader of the Jewish people, and Antoninus, Marcus Aurelius Antoninus, the aforementioned Roman emperor. Rome, well, that's the embodiment of Esav. And this one Roman emperor, well, he's the best version of Esav, and this is the powerful one, the prideful ones that's within Rebecca's uterus. Now, there's a lot of discussion as to how exactly Esav, who was living in Israel, in Edom, which is maybe to the southeast of Israel, he's in Mount Seir, but he's certainly a Semite. He's in the Middle East. How does he end up across the Mediterranean in Italy? How does he end up in Rome? When we say that Rome is Esav, doesn't mean just that the ideals of Rome are an embodiment of the philosophy of Esav. It means that quite literally, the founding of Rome was done by descendants of Esav. So there's a lot of discussion about how exactly Esav and his families and his lineage, how they ended up in Europe. And there are a variety of explanations. In one explanation, Sancheriv, he was the Assyrian king. He's the one who conquered the northern kingdom of Israel and sent the 10 lost tribes to parts unknown. When he conquered Esav, he did to them what he did to the 10 lost tribes, just like he took the 10 lost tribes and sent them away. That was his policy. It was a policy of relocation. You take a nation, you conquer it, and you move them somewhere else. And they're displaced people, they're uncomfortable, and you just mix everything up. That's what he did. So he took the Jews, the nation of Israel, the 10 lost tribes, he takes them out of Israel, moves them away, and in their stead, he places the Samaritans. And he tried to conquer Judea, but he lost to Histia. Well, he conquered Esav. And he displaced them like he displaced the rest of his subjects, and he moved them to Italy. And that's one explanation as to how Esav ended up in Rome. Alternatively, there is another interpretation featured by the Ramban in the book of Genesis, chapter 49, verse 31, where he tells about a war that happened between Joseph, who was the viceroy of Egypt, and some of the families of Esav. And it tells a whole story how Joseph won the battle, and he incarcerated some of the descendants of Esav, and they escaped from Egypt, and they went to Italy, and eventually became king, and they founded Rome. Regardless, Rome is always symbolic of Esav, and it's antithetical to Jacob. And these two were forced in utero to be in very close proximity to each other. And that's why it just didn't work out, because they're opposites. Like when you take a magnet and you flip it over to the side that's not attracting each other but repelling each other, there's tension, right? Because they're pushing away from each other. Jacob and Esav are opposites. They don't work well together. And you force them into utero together, they're fighting like cats and dogs all the time, because there's no way for these two to coexist. And in fact, in Rashi's commentary to the birth narrative, to the gestation narrative of Jacob and Esav, Rashi tells us that this battle, this inability to coexist between Jacob and Esav, that it's quite literally similar to the magnets. When one's on top, the other one has to be on bottom. Again, they're repelling each other. They're opposites. When one ascends, the other one falls. And the Talmud actually tells us, if someone tells you that Rome and Jerusalem are both destroyed, don't believe them. If someone tells you that they're both flourishing, Rome and Jerusalem, don't believe them. If someone tells you that Rome is thriving and Jerusalem is destroyed, or Jerusalem is thriving and Rome is destroyed, then you can believe them. They are opposites. If one is up, the other must be down. They are always going to be inverted from each other. Messiah, he's the complete embodiment of Jacob. He's 100% Jacob. And he is a Metzora in Rome. In Rome, he is an outcast. He is unwelcome. He is expelled from the city. In Rome, in the epicenter of Esav, there's no way for him to be there. He cannot be in the city. He has to be outside the city. He has to be kicked out of the city. He's unwelcome in Rome because these two, again, cannot coexist. Now, here's where things get interesting. There's a reverse Messiah. There's the opposite of Messiah. You recall we mentioned earlier that the serpent, the snake, in the Genesis story, he got Saras. He spoke Lashon Hara, the Midrash in our Parsha tells us, and he got Saras. And that's the scales on the skin of the serpent. To me, there's perfect symmetry here. The snake was expelled as a Metzora. The Metzora is kicked out of Rome. The snake was kicked out of where? Of paradise. Of heaven. In a place that is 100% spiritual. In a place that's 100% Jacob. Well, from there, the serpent is expelled. Just as Messiah is completely incompatible with Rome, the snake is completely incompatible with the place that he was expelled from, with paradise, with Gan Eden. Now, it's fascinating. If you look at the gematria, so the numerical value of the word for snake, nachash, it's three letters, nun, ches, and shin, nachash, that's a snake, that's a serpent. Well, the nun is 50, the ches is 8, and the shin is 300, so 358. That is the exact same gematria as the word Mashiach. The mem is 40. The shin is, again, 300, so 340. The yud is 10, 350, and the ches, Mashiach, is 8, 358. The commentaries all note that the nachash, the serpent, the primordial serpent, that's 358, and Messiah is 358. And we now know that they both had saras, right? They both had saras. So they're the same thing, just complete mirror images of each other. They're both at odds, completely at odds, with the world that represents the opposite of them. They're both a Metzora from the world, from the universe in which the opposite side reigns. So they're the same, they're mirror images of each other, but in opposite directions. Messiah is unwelcome in Rome, and the serpent is unwelcome in heaven. Jacob also has a Rome. Jacob also has an epicenter. That's paradise. And from there, the snake is expelled. And thus Messiah, that is the complete opposite idea of the serpent in heaven. And in fact, the Talmud tells us that the showdown really of Messiah is Messiah against the serpent. 358 versus 358. Who is going to win? Spoiler alert, we know who's going to win. And that's the role of Messiah. Messiah's job is to eliminate the Yetzer Hara. People wonder, well, how is the whole world going to change? If all you did was eliminate the Yetzer Hara, in a second, the entire world changes. The only way that we can ignore the reality of God, the only way that we can have that concealed, it's only because of the existence of the Yetzer Hara, of the evil inclination. The evil inclination is called the foreign god because that is the force that obstructs our ability to connect and to perceive and to submit ourselves before the Almighty. Now, when I was talking over this idea with my study partner, Rabbi Byron, he gave me a Botnikian insight. He just came up with this on the spot, just to get a sense of the kind of caliber of people we're dealing with here. This just popped up on the spot. Listen to this. Listen to this. So, Messiah, well, that's 358. Nachash, the serpent, that's also 358. And we explain, they're opposites. Messiah is the Metzorah. He's the one who has Tzaras outside of Rome. And the snake, the serpent, well, he's also the Metzorah. He's also the leper outside of paradise. The Rome, so to speak, the epicenter, the headquarters of Jacob. There's one person who is 358 plus 358. There's one person who is unwelcome both in Rome and in Jerusalem. There's someone who's the eternal outcast. There's one person who's not, who's 358 plus 358. Well, what's that? That's 716, right? How would you figure that out? Because 350 plus 350 is 700, and 8 plus 8 is 16. There's a third person who has tzaras, but it's the kind of tzaras that makes them completely unwelcome in both environments. The Talmud tells us that the reason why Vashti, the first wife of Ahasuerus in the Purim story, the reason why she didn't want to come to the king's party, Talmud tells us the book of Megillah, page 12b, she had tzaras. Well, here's yet another person who has tzaras. The name Vashti, what's the gematria? Well, the Vav is 6, the Shin is 300, the Taf is 400, so that's 706, and the Yud, that's 10, that's 716. So Rabbi Byron says, wait a minute, if we have the Nachash, the serpent, 358, and Messiah, 358, Vashti, she's also a Metzor, she also has Tzaras, and she's 716, because she's the one who's not welcome neither in Jerusalem and neither in Rome. She's wicked. She represents the Yetzer Hara. We don't want her. We have nothing to do with her. We learn the Talmud tells us all the terrible things she used to do to the Jewish girls that she enslaved. And even Ahasuerus doesn't want her. So she is unwelcome in both Jerusalem and Rome. She's anathema to both Jacob and Esav. She's a pariah, like both the snake and Messiah. The snake would be very comfortable in Rome. Messiah is very comfortable in Jerusalem, in paradise. They're only a Metzorah for the opposite camp, for the opposite headquarters. Vashti is 716. Well, she's unwelcome in both. Now, the reason why this is a bit of a distressing idea is because a lot of us have some rosy expectations for what Messiah is going to look like. Because after all, it does refer to a world of utopia, world peace, prosperity for all. Everyone's united under one flag. Everyone's going to acknowledge the existence and supremacy, complete supremacy of God. And everyone's going to say, we want to do your will. That's the world that we are anticipating. It's a world of 100% Jacob. And there's no place for Esav. And this is symbolized with the grabbing of the ankle, right? When these two children are born, well, Esav comes out first. He's got the head start. And the last moment, Jacob grabs his ankle. He catapults him at the very end. So it's the triumph of Jacob over Esav and the complete decapitation of everything Esav related. Our world, it's a world very much still dominated by Esav, by Rome. We could call it maybe Western culture, Western civilization. It's a world dominated by Esav. And I think we may be a bit shocked to learn that the world of Messiah, it's completely 1,000% incompatible with Esav. Completely incompatible with Esav. 100%. He is outside of Rome. He's outside of the city. He's unwelcome in the city. Now, when I was having a chat with a friend of mine on Shabbos, he told me something that you will find disturbing. He said that, well, it's a little complicated because my friend on Shabbos told me what he heard from someone else who heard from someone else. So it's a little bit of a difficult idea to try to source. But he cited someone who said the following. It was a conversation from the 70s. In the 70s, there was the Islamic Revolution. And someone was lamenting the fact that the radical Muslims, the mullahs, the ayatollah, they went and they were shattering all sorts of things. All sorts of elements of the modernity that was in Persia, in Iran. And they were saying how terrible it is that these mullahs come and they destroy all these things, all these elements of society and culture. And the great rabbi, again, we don't know who this is, but this is what someone told me. He's like, well, what do you think is going to happen to the Messiah? And it's disturbing because we don't want to associate in any way with the radicals and the Islamists of the revolution. But I think on a conceptual level, we have to understand that Messiah, he's the antithesis of Rome. And a lot of our perceptions of the world, a lot of our worldview, a lot of our Weltanschauung is molded and shaped by Esav. A lot of our obsession with materialism, our obsession with physicality, our overemphasis or overindexing on matters of this world to the exclusion of matters of the spiritual world. A lot of us are influenced to some degree or another still by the attitudes and the ideals and the values and the priorities of Esav. And we're learning about a Metzorah. Our parsha talks about the Metzorah. The Metzorah has to go outside the city. And no one can associate with them. They're not welcome at all amongst the populace. Messiah is completely unwelcome in Rome. And the reverse is also true. Rome is completely unwelcome in Messiah. And that's a scary idea. It's distressing. It is topical because, you know, this is the month of redemption. And we know that Messiah will come, or at least one element of Messiah will happen in the month of Nisan. And the distressing idea is, all of us, to some extent or another, we have a little bit of Rome still operating within us. Esav still has a little foothold within us. The values, the ideals, the priorities of Esav still play a role. And that is something we're going to have to give up in the times of Messiah. And maybe we should even consider how much we can let go of Esav, how much we can re-embrace the ideals of Jacob, how much we can try to live our life today to make it as compatible as possible with Jerusalem, with the heaven. How much of a role does the serpent still play in our lives? It's not inconsequential. This is the podcast that I wanted to share with you before Pesach. I like it. I have to say, this is an idea that I like. I know it's a challenging idea, and it's maybe a bit distressing, and we want everything. We want to have the prowess of Esav and the physicality, materialism of Esav, but also the great spiritual conquests and the great spiritual values and mores of Jacob. And here we're discovering that no, they're not compatible. And that's a bit distressing. But I think it's certainly something to ponder. I love the concept again, because every time I read this Talmud, I was like, whoa, what's he doing? Messiah, a Torah sitting outside of Rome. It's such a provocative teaching in the Talmud. And I think this is an interpretation that we can share. I enjoyed it. I like it. I think it's a nice way to sign off this semester. We're off next week. We're off. What are we going to do? How are we going to celebrate it? Are we going to have withdrawal symptoms? Is it going to be hard to get back on track the week after Pesach? It might be. This is a serious concern. But next week, there's no parsha. It's the festival of Pesach. I wish all of y'all to have a wonderful Pesach, an uplifting Pesach, a chag kosher v'sameach, a happy and kosher Pesach. And may we indeed merit to witness Messiah and the redemption and the restoration of the Davidic monarchy speedily in our days. Have a wonderful day. Have a wonderful Shabbos. Have a splendid Pesach. And please, God, we'll talk again after Pesach. And as always, my email address is rabbiwolbe@gmail.com.